Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does one track a killer over thousands of miles of the American West with the freedom to travel over a newly built rail system, the will to cause unprecedented damage to vital transportation arteries, and the skills to carry it out without leaving as much as a fingerprint behind? That's the challenge for a fictional hero named Isaac Bell. The newest book to focus on Bell is named for its villain, The Wrecker. The story sends the detective in search of a relentless and seemingly superhuman saboteur in the early years of the 20th century. The book is the second in the Isaac Bell series and the 40th penned by best-selling novelist and adventurer Clive Cussler. He's in town for a book signing event that will take place tonight at 7 at the Barnes & Noble store at Lincoln Park in Dallas. We're delighted that he could be here with us this afternoon. Clive, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
So a lot of your fans know you for these marine adventures. This, though, with Isaac Bell, you've taken a firm step into the Western genre. Can you talk about how the differences in setting affects the kinds of things that you're able to do with a story?
Well, I just, like so many writers, you know, I always wanted to do a certain, you know, genre, and I never did. And I always wanted to write a Western. But I didn't want to write one where, you know, it was like 1870s and stagecoaches and horses and cowboys and bandits and all that. So I thought it'd be fun to put it up after the turn of the century. Then I could bring in old automobiles, motorcycles, you know, all sorts of, you know, the new technology. And so the first one, I remember I started in 1905 and then developed this detective. And then I had him go to San Francisco, and then it occurred to me that if I moved it up a year, I could include the earthquake.
Talk about a dramatic plot point.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the research that, you know, went into the whole thing as far as, and then the ladies too. I mean, the fashions in those days, describing that, and the Gibson girl was quite mm-hmm. quite big then. So that's and what music they danced to, and it was great fun.
I have to say, I have to imagine that the majority of your regular readers are men, but you do a really good job describing women's clothes.
Well, actually, 50% of my readership
is
are
that
women.
Right?
Women,
wow.
Women love adventure.
Mm-hmm. Well. And they're always kind of sexy too. These heroes.
Yeah, but I don't use four letter words or any sex.
No.
Really,
no.
In mine, but no, I think the women just enjoy it because they like an adventurous hero and as I say, I always try to make the women fashionable, and they're all intelligent. There's no bimbos in my book, so.
It must be fun when you decide you're going to start something new to get into that research process.
Yeah, it is. It's because the research is what's really enjoyable. I love the research. The writing, of course, is work. But I'll spend maybe 2-3 months on the research before I start the book, and then I'm researching all the way through as I've run too. So it's a combination of work and fun.
Now, you've been writing since 65. Do you now go first to the internet when you start researching, or do you still like to do a lot of field work and interviews and go to books?
Well, you have to do the interviews and books, of course, but not as much as I used to. I used to, you know, most of the information I got would be in a library. Mm-hmm. But now you can go on the internet, and 90% of it is there. So it makes it easy for all the authors.
Are there times, I know with your sort of undersea books, you have a really deep personal interest in that. Do you mm-hmm. try to sort of live any of the experiences that you give your characters?
Oh, a little bit. And some of the diving, of course, they get into far more mischief than I do, and they find, you know, many things I don't. But it's just the idea of we don't know really what's beyond the sea. You know, we've photographed every square inch of the moon, and we haven't done 1% of, you know, the sea bottom yet. So it's fun to come up with, you know, particularly shipwrecks, because they're a great mystery. And I stated one time that going through an old shipwreck is like walking through a haunted house. Mm-hmm. And so it's great, you know, it's a mystery, and then people are drawn to it.
You've actually gone hunting for shipwrecks and mm-hmm. found many significant ones. What is that process like? Do you know basically where you're looking, and then you hope that on a particular trip you'll actually find it?
You hope, right. You don't always take the, all right, I was sitting around, and there was so much hoopla on the Titanic, mm-hmm. you know, this and that, and they're diving in the movies and what have you. And I thought, there's been nothing on the Carpathia, which was the ship that rescued the Titanic mm-hmm. survivors. So I researched it out, thinking it was probably scrapped, you know, and turned out it was torpedoed in World War I off Ireland. So I formed three expeditions, and we found it on the third. And the Carpathia is just a marvelous story, you know, how it saved the survivors of the Titanic.
And do you then own what you pull up, or do you, does it go to a museum, or are there international treaties that govern that sort of thing?
Well, there's all that. Usually the artifacts would be owned government, state mostly, but we've never taken NUMA, National Underwater Marine Agency, I formed as a nonprofit, so we don't take any artifacts. We never have. So the artifacts, if we do bring up, are used to identification and then arranged to have them preserved. And then hopefully put on display for the public, such as the great find we made was the Confederate submarine Hunley in Charleston, and they're restoring that.
I want to talk about these shifts in your career, and I guess the NUMA work is sort of an avocation, but you started out working in the military and aviation, and then you were an ad copywriter. How did you find your way to what you're doing now?
Well, I when I was in advertising, I started to write when my wife took she wanted to do something. So she took a fascinating job working evenings for the local police department, you know, just as a dispatcher, secretary, that sort of thing. So I'd come home and I'd feed the kids, put them to bed, you know, nobody to talk to, nothing to do. So I thought, gee, I think I'll write a book. And so not having the great, you know, literary novel burning inside me, I thought it'd be fun to do a little paperback series. Mm-hmm. So I studied all the series heroes, beginning with Inspector DuPont. Edgar Allan Poe was the first one, and then, of course, Sherlock Holmes and Mike Hammer and Travis McGee and James Bond and all of them. And then I thought, well, what can I do that's different? So I thought I'd take my hero and put him in and around water, and Dirk Pitt was born there.
What do all those guys have in common that you went and looked at?
Guys or ships? Or
no, all those detective heroes that you looked at before you started writing.
Well, of course, it would depend on the stories, of course, and just like Agatha Christie, you know, in her mysteries, you always pick the one who's the least obvious, and that was always the one who was guilty. And some of them, you know, like a Bond is more adventurous, you know, where Travis McGee is a little more, you know, detective mystery and so on. So, but it was just interesting to see what different types of heroes they were and then to come up with a different one.
Let's talk about Isaac Bell, who this is just his second book. And he is different in some ways. Obviously, he's landlocked and he works for a detective agency.
Right. I made him. This was interesting because I know when I first started the first Dirk Pitt novel, I made him a blonde because I thought they're all dark. You know? And then I researched and surveyed women and found they still like the dark, you know, mysterious guys. So I made Pitt, you know, black hair. But I thought, Bell, I'm not, since I'm not dealing with, you know, the same time era and everything. So I made him blonde with a big blonde mustache. And he's very wealthy, but he works for this detective agency, like the Pinkertons, but it's called Van Horn. And he drives, you know, jazzy old locomobile, race car, and an Indian motorcycle, which they had, of course, in those days. He has a very lovely fiance, and... So it's a fun character, and there's, of course, nobody like him, and the fact that he's in an era nobody writes about. So I love to do something that nobody else does.
I really like that you open the book with a scene of Isaac Bell as a much older man. He's in his mid-60s, and he is still every bit as dashing and clever and fast with a weapon.
Yeah, it's great fun, and of course they're in the end, you know. Then it's the book is like the epilogue is the prologue in a sense. So that's always fun to do too. I like to use a historic prologue in the beginning, and in the Dirk Pitt books, an old school chum of mine, his name is Lee Hunt. I always killed off a Lee Hunt in all the prologues. And Lee used to call me and complain. He says, why can't I be more of a hero inside the book? And I said, stop complaining. I made you famous, you know. So it's like you say, I write them so that the reader has fun reading them.
When did you start putting little cameos of yourself in the books?
Oh, that was funny. That was a book called Dragon, and Dirk Pitt was at a classic car concourse meet. And I had him walk over to the fellow that had the next car, and I just happened to describe him as this old gray-haired guy with a beard. And Pitt said, hello, my name's Dirk Pitt. And just typing it without knowing it, I typed, hello, I'm Clive Cussler. And I thought, why did I do that? And I thought, oh, I'll leave it just for fun. I love to do stuff that nobody else does. So I left it in, and my God, I received 600 letters.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, it was staggering. So now I have to make my walk on like Alfred Hitchcock. And everybody's always like, I can't wait to see how you come on this time. So it's great fun because most authors don't put themselves in the book, you know. So there again, I know the readers enjoy it.
I think one thing that's appealing about you is that you do seem to sort of enjoy it. And as you say, you didn't have the great American novel burning in you. It's almost liberating that you're not sort of sweating over every word. You're there to tell a really good, fast story.
That's right. And I think, I know, you know, the 15 years I spent as an advertising copywriter and creative director, you know, I got so used to writing the short, snappy copy that when I started writing books, the sentences are you know, meaningful without, you know, going on for, you know, 500 words. In fact, I have English teachers, high school and college, who have written to me that they always teach my openings because they go very quickly. And the one that they all rave about, I think, was Valhalla Rising. And the opening line is, the intruder came from beyond. And they just all think, you know, what more could you say to get somebody interested in reading a book? So it's fun.
How much time do you spend relative to the rest of the writing of the book thinking about that first scene?
Well, I'm doing all the research, and that's the months. I'm always constructing the prologue, and I always try to get it off, you know, like a, you know, at the starter's gun. And because if you don't really hook the reader in the first sentence or paragraph, you know, they start slowing down. But if you can grab them then, you can keep them pretty much, you know, as you go through the book. So it's what I try to give the reader what they would like to see. You know, I'm not psychic, but, you know, I can think, well, you know, what would I like and what would they like, and then try and work it in.
So once you have a hero established and you're working in the middle of a series, for each individual book, do you start with the criminal, or do you the character of the criminal, or do you start with the crime?
It varies. Mm-hmm. I can start with a crime just as easily and then, you know, work it in. And I had one book, I think, where the hero, Dirk Pitt, didn't show up until page 80. So there again, it's always fascinating to do something different, you know, without keeping it all the same. And but you have to have the ending to work towards, you know. But up until then, it's fun to do different things and create different ideas and circumstances, and it makes interesting reading.
So you never leave the ending open for yourself. You start writing that book knowing what's going to happen.
I know the ending. I may not have the middle, you know, and that just seems to fall into place as I go. It's kind of crazy. I'm not, you know, certainly a smart man. I think I only got 108 in an IQ test in high school. But I can juggle it all in my head. I never do a draft. And the only notes I make are a character might have green eyes and you know, blonde hair. Because it's amazing. While you're writing, for some reason, you know, all of a sudden you've changed the character to red hair and blue eyes. And you don't know why. And names change. And an editor say, why did you change the name? And I said, I didn't change the name. Well, here it is. It's a different name, you know. So I just keep notes on the characters and things like that. But I don't do an outline. I don't do drafts. When I finish the final one, or the first final one, then I just go back, edit it, you know, clean it up and send it in.
Novelist Clive Cussler is with us. His newest book is called The Wrecker. We'll return to our conversation in a moment and invite you to join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist Clive Cussler. His newest book is called The Wrecker. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think at kera.org. There's so many cool scenes involving these old trains, and I have to say I learned a lot. I didn't know, for example, that wealthy people would have not just their own car sometimes, but their own locomotive.
Mm-hmm. It's true. The owners of the railroad, mm-hmm. the big shots and all that, they would have their own private train. And the cars, of course, that they had, it would be more than one car, too. They'd have maybe two or three or four. And they're very ornate, you know, the expense was... No barriers there. But it was fascinating getting into all that, and then the different locomotives too, the Baldwin Pacific and the Baldwin Atlantic, and one was a little faster than the other, and different drive wheels and all that. So it was fascinating because I'm old enough to remember the old steam locomotives. I remember when my dad traveled and standing there at the on the rail platform. When the engine came in, and I'd stand there and watch these big drive wheels, and then the engineer would lean out and hit the steam button, you know, for me. It was great fun. And when you see one, every once in a while, when they take one out and that's been restored and really push it down the line, it's so great just seeing those drive wheels just, you know, spinning away and turning and the smoke pouring out. And it's a wonderful era, you know, that's gone. We'll never see again.
Yeah, there's a romance to that you don't get in the era of private jets.
No.
You're a car guy, I know, and it comes up in every single book. Can you tell us a little bit about your collection?
Yeah, it's, what is it now? I think it's 108. I used to just collect and store in a warehouse, and then my daughter took it over and turned it into a museum. She's done a wonderful job with it. And one side are the old classics, and the other side are 50s convertibles. And... they were just, I love the old 50s because it was just great big, you know, chrome barges and 300 horsepower we'll never see again. You know, I always laugh. There's the 59 Lincoln, a big continental huge thing. And I always say that when you bought one of those, you got your own zip code. And then the classics are just great fun. And they'll be someday, particularly the coach makers, the coach built cars, many of them are like a one-off. And it was fascinating, the chauffeur of rich people. It would be, you know, his boss would say, I think it's time we got a new car. So the chauffeur would go down to if they drove Packards, we'll say, to the Packard dealership, arrange for the car. He would get a commission, which was known by the dealer and the owner, too. And then the chassis and the engine would come to the dealer, who would then send it to a coachmaker.
So the car would be unduplicated.
Unduplicated. And the coachmaker then would know, if you ever saw like the movie The Yellow Rolls Royce, they'd have all the dimensions because they did the car before for the rich people. And just like, they sit there, well, you know, the crystal, you know, glasses and in the back seat, I'd prefer them square rather than round and things like that and the measurements for, you know, the lady and the everything. So... it was an era too that was just marvelous in the coach built cars, and someday, because some of the coach builders, particularly the French, did really exotic works, and these coachmakers will someday be like a Van Gogh, say 100, 200 years from now, and because they're mechanical works of art.
Do you still have any interest in restoring them yourself, or mm-hmm. now that you can afford it, would you rather just pass it off to someone who will make it perfect for you?
Well, it's better to buy it, mm-hmm. you know, or purchase it in immaculate number one shape.
Yeah.
Because even if you buy it at a cheaper, you know, price and it needs work, it still takes you a couple of years to really restore it to the level you want. So, but I used to work on the cars a lot in the old days. I don't live there. The museum's outside of Denver, and I'm down in, of course, Arizona, so I only get up a few times a year. But it's fun to take them out and drive them.
Do you reserve the right to sort of show up outside Denver and say, I want to take that one for a spin?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I call my daughter, and I'm coming in. She says, you know, the guys, the little crew, you know, they'll get the car out you want. The one I like to drive is a 1929 Bentley. And it was a car that, not that particular one, but the same type that used to win Le Mans all the time in those days, the 24-hour race. And it's like the gear shift and the brake are on the outside of the door.
Oh, wow.
It's fun. And it's just driving down the street, and it has this roar to it, you know, and it's just, I don't know, I was born 80 years too late, I think. And,
do you allow yourself to really push it, or do you think this is a very expensive classic automobile and I have to be careful?
Oh, no, that one I can push, because it's interesting. The you have the like the Cadillac Owners Club, the Buick Owners Club, the Rolls-Royce Owners Club, but the Bentley is the Bentley Drivers Club.
Huh.
And all the people that own Bentleys drive them, take them on tours. I remember I came up to the warehouse or the museum one day, and here were these two old Bentleys like mine. And these fellas had shipped them from New Zealand and then to Anchorage and then drove them down from Alaska. So they're just driven all over the place. And but there again, you know, if you restore a Bentley engine, you're talking $65,000.
Are you still always on the prowl for the next big thing?
Yeah, it's always, you know, but it's getting harder to find. You don't find them in the barns like you used to, you know. Jay Leno has luck because people call him, you know.
Because they know he collects.
Yeah, right. And I remember it was funny a few years ago. He let me, you know, visit his collection, and he asked me, I said, how many cars do you have? And he said, 36. He said, how many do you have? And I stood there for a moment, and I finally said, 37. But now I think he's got, like, I think close to 200, and I'm about 108 or something.
So are there things that you would, have you ever talked about trading anything with him?
No. No, I bought him, because he was going off the air, so I bought him a little present because of all the years he entertained, you know, my family and I. But I got him one of these Barbie doll cars and sent it. And he called when he got it. He said, what are people going to think of me?
What do you think people expect your life is like, and what is it like in terms of your writing day? Do you think people have an accurate assessment of what it's like for you when you're at work?
I think people that don't write don't know how hard it is, and by that I don't mean a brain strain necessarily, but it's a lonely life because I go into my office and I'm there from say 8:30 till, you know, 6:30 at night, and just immersed in, you know, the writing. So you have to have a lot of perseverance, because when you type chapter one, you know you're committing yourself for the next year, year and a half, 2 years, whatever it takes. And it's you have to have a lot of, as I say, perseverance to keep going, because so many writers will write a chapter and quit, you know, and this sort of a thing. So it's not easy. I don't say it's hard work, of course, but it's not a simple procedure. But it's dull, very dull, of course. It's boring almost, but you just have to hang in there and keep, you know, banging away until you type the end. And when I type the end, I feel like I've been paroled from prison.
And then, how much of a break do you give yourself before you start again?
Oh, maybe 6 months. I go out and look for shipwrecks and chase after old cars, you know. So I've got something to do when I'm not writing.
Then it's time to get back in the office.
Oh yeah, I could probably have written, you know, not as many books as Stephen King, but a lot more if I, you know, just wrote and nothing else.
I know that you sometimes, including for this one, work with a second writer now.
Yes.
How different is the process when you have someone else on the team?
Oh, it's fun, because now you take the Dirk Pitt series. You know, I thought I'd age him. Because, you know, James Bond never ages, and I thought, you know, there again, I like to be different. So he's aging slowly, and, you know, he's say, 45. Well, we both started when we were about 36. You know, he's 45, I'm 78, and that's not fair. But, and then another thing that was interesting, too, his first love in the first book died in an underwater earthquake. And I don't know why, but every second, third book, I'd have him maybe sitting in an airplane, he stares out the window and reminisces about his lost love. And then finally, when my son, I worked with him to write, the first one was Black Wind, and he's very good. And so I came up with this book, the titles.
There's 40 of them, so you can be forgiven for
Trojan Odyssey. And in the end, Pitt finally marries the Colorado congresswoman he's been going with for several books. And then at the end, when they're practically on their honeymoon, the bell rings where this hangar he lives with his old cars. You open the door and hear these two, you know, a boy and a girl, they're twins, and they, you know, they look just like him. And it turns out that she didn't die, but she was horribly misfigured, didn't want to tell him, and had these two kids, and then raised them. And when she was dying, she sent them to him. And so now they're in the book. Of course, the main characters, Dirk and Al Giardino, will still come and save the day. But as time goes on, I'm not going to live forever. So my son Dirk will take over the writing, and then, you know, Pitt and Giardino eventually kind of fade some, and the kids will take over.
So you're passing on the legacy within the book and also outside the book.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I think it's, there again, nobody's done that, and I think it's great fun.
Clive Cussler is my guest. His newest novel is called The Wrecker. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. I read someplace, Clive, that you hated school when you were a kid.
Yeah, I did. I just hated school. I remember I used to sit in algebra and stare out the window, and you know, and I was a million miles away on a pirate ship, this kind of a thing. And I just, my dad was this old German, and he used to just get mad because, you know, my report cards, I never got an F. But if I could squeak through with a C or a D, that was good enough for me. And I just wasn't for me, I guess. And the teachers never could appreciate somebody who was creative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you got good marks and all that, fine. But, you know, I wasn't the only kid that was really creative that they just wrote off as a lost cause, you know. Because I know it's when I've spoken to, which I have, teachers' conferences, things like that, and I'm always asked what teacher inspired me, and I say I didn't have one. You know, none of them did. So it was fun. I as I say, and I used to write plays and, you know, goofy things like that. But nope, school was not for me. I didn't even go back to college. So then my son always gets mad because he went through college and then worked and got his MBA, and then they asked me to speak. Give the commencement address, you know, and they said, we'll give you an honorary degree. And I laughed, and I said, okay, fine. So as we were getting ready to go out, the dean of the school said, oh, by the way, it's not honorary, it's a real one.
Huh.
And I said, how is that possible? And they said, well, this was New York, the Maritime College. He said, the Board of Chancellors of the State of New York and the governor, they all agreed that you'd written two books on shipwrecks and found all these wrecks, and then, you know, in recognition, they said, you know, we can use that as your thesis and give you a real PhD.
That's great.
In maritime history. I never used the doctor or anything, but it's there. It's fun. So it's been kind of a fun life. I've enjoyed it, and it's been very varied, and I don't know. I'll go on for a while longer, I hope.
1-800-933-5372 is the number if you'd like to speak with novelist Clive Cussler. His latest book is called The Wrecker. Let's speak with Mike in Plano. Hello, Mike.
Yes.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Hello. I'm a big fan of Cleve's, and I've read most all of them, I think. And I had a question about Sierra was one of my favorites, and they made a movie version of it. I'd like to know what you thought of it.
Somebody always asked me that. I wasn't keen on it. Of course, didn't follow the book very well. And the characters, you know, the fellow that played Rudy Gunn, for example, was a blithering idiot, where Gunn was, you know, number one in this class at Annapolis. And then the fellow that played Al Giardino, he wasn't even close to Al. And Matthew McConaughey was the best they could do for a Dirk Pitt. We would have liked to have Hugh Jackman, but he was on another project, so... No, I wasn't wild about it.
That must be really hard when you have something you're proud of, a story that you've sweated over for a year and a half, to hand it over knowing it could be brilliant or it could be just really disappointing.
Mm-hmm. That was like the movie they made Raise the Titanic. You know, other than the bringing up the ship, I didn't recognize any of the rest of the story.
Are you reluctant after those experiences to put these out and let them be films?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm not keen on selling out again. Maybe the kids will someday, but I don't plan to.
Did you worry at all before you started working on the books with your son, Dirk? Did you worry that this would have any impact on the relationship that you have as father and son?
Not father and son. Actually, it worked out very well because we'll sit down and work out the concepts and the plots, as I mentioned, and the characters, and then, you know, he'll start writing and I'll edit and rewrite. No, there was no problems there whatsoever. The problem I was kind of concerned about was how it would come out in the end and what my agent and my editor, Putnam, would think, you know. So the book was finished, it's sent in, and, you know, I thought, oh, gosh, we're going to catch it from, you know, this sort of thing. And they both, you know, were astounded. They said, my God, it's seamless. We can't tell where you left off and he took over. Mm-hmm. So it's been very nice and very wonderful, and I'm just happy because it'd be nice to see the series go on, you know. And
did you recognize him as a writer when he was a kid?
Yeah, he always wrote very well. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it was mostly like letters and things like that. And even his sisters used to go on about how well he wrote. And he'd been in 13 years in financial analyst for Motorola, and he just got tired of it. And I said, why don't you write a Dirk Pitt book? And he said, oh, I can't do that. And I said, I'll work with you on it. So we did, and it turned out a pretty good book, and now he's off and running.
It must be very exciting to have something that you love so much mm-hmm. and then see your kids really take
it
on. Even
is.
With the thing with the cars and mm-hmm. your daughter working that
yeah.
there.
Mm-hmm. It's great.
Mm-hmm. Do you have grandkids?
I'm sorry?
Do you have grandkids?
Yes. My son was in his 40s when he got married and had two daughters. And my oldest daughter was 18 when she got married. So the youngest ones are 4 and 6, and their cousins are 28 and 30.
So you've got a wide span there.
It's a big span, right. It's fun.
Clive Cussler is my guest. His new novel is called The Wrecker. We'll return to our conversation in a moment, and you can get on the line now to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist Clive Cussler. His latest book is called The Wrecker. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So at the end of your office day, Clive, you come home at 6:30 or whatever. Mm-hmm. Is it a process to turn off the part of your brain that was thinking and imagining and working all day?
It just seems to go off automatically. Mm-hmm. My wife and I, particularly, we have this nice yard and like a spa. And so I'll come off and we'll sit there and we'll open a bottle of wine and we'll both, we'll split the cigar. She likes cigars. And we'll sit there till about 7:38 and then, you know, then we'll fix dinner. And it's just fun to kind of just slow down and, cut it off and particularly the wine and the cigar. It's just it's enjoyable.
Not a bad end to any day.
No.
Have you ever struggled with not being able to think of what you wanted to do next?
No, I've always been very fortunate. Usually an idea will come to me when I'm in the middle of the book I'm writing, mm-hmm. you know, for the next one. And so when I do type the end, I've got kind of a direction, you know, and then I start doing the research and working it out and putting it together.
Do you continue to read other people's books and fiction while you're writing, or do you avoid that while you're working on a book yourself?
Well, I don't avoid it, but I just don't have time to read fiction. I had lunch with James Michener many years ago, and I jokingly said, have you read any good books lately, Jim? And he laughed, said, no. He says, because I'm always researching.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much the same way with me. Now, I will read first books by new authors, and if they're pretty good, I'll give them an endorsement. and that seems to help, and they all enjoy it. And they think I'm lucky, too, because I endorsed Tom Clancy's The Hunt for Red October.
You know a good book when you see one.
Yes, and then I made a quote and endorsed Stephen Kuhn's Flight of the Intruder. And then the one that really threw me over the top is, if you look on the back, you'll find that I endorsed the Da Vinci Code.
So, too bad there's not some cash attached to that.
Yeah, oh, yeah. That's everybody. Oh, get him. He's lucky. You know, that's about the only fiction I read. It's mostly nonfiction.
That's how it goes for me as well. In fact, it's exciting when we have a novelist in here because I get the chance. I get an excuse to read a novel. Mm-hmm. Just for fun. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Wayne in Denton. Hello, Wayne.
Hello, good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to let Mr. Kussler know that I was introduced to his writing and his novels through one of his cars. In the early 1990s, I was, one Saturday morning with nothing to do, I looked out the window of the Marriott there in Golden, Colorado, and I noticed what looked like a kind of an impromptu auto meet. And I walked over and was admiring the cars and motorcycles, and there was, I think, a Pierce Arrow with a matching travel trailer attached to it, and no one around it to talk to, and I waited for quite a while and couldn't speak to the owner, and then I happened to notice a small plate on the bumper. It said, "Owner, Clive Kussler." That very day when I was at the bookstore, I ran across Clive Kussler and have been reading your novels ever since, as well as some of your nonfiction. And I just wanted to say thank you for not only sharing that automobile and that experience with myself and other members of the public, but it opened up your books for me by going and doing research on whatever collectible you happen to write about and add into your novels. And that experience is something that I've carried over into other authors and in doing so. And it really opened up their works for me. And I wanted to thank you for that.
Oh, I'm so glad you enjoyed them. And I'm very grateful. Thank you. You made my day.
Do you ever feel a little bit protective of the cars and the motorcycles and the things that you've collected now that they're on public display?
No. I figure it's great that, you know, other people can enjoy them. Mm-hmm. No, I never felt protective or anything like that.
Let's go next on the phones to Mark in Justin. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Go ahead, please.
I just had a comment. I happened to be on vacation in Mexico and reading one of Clive's books. And back, I was deeply engrossed. And back in the back of my head, I heard, "Meester, Meester." And it turns out the lady next to me was reading the book, and it had been translated in Italian. It was the same book, and we both agreed, by the way, it was great.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Do you have any, I can't imagine you speak all the languages into which your books have been translated. Does anything have to change when you have an Italian edition or a Spanish edition?
Oh, it changes. Of course, I don't speak Italian. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has to take a translator. But the changes creep in, and people who can, you know, read both will sometimes call me that, "This doesn't sound right," or, you know, something like that. But, no, they usually do a pretty good job.
And are the covers usually the same?
No, they do different covers. And it's amazing. Russia, for example, and Poland do magnificent covers. And the British really do terrific artwork. So it's fun to see, you know, what the different countries do with them.
Yeah, I would imagine it's surprising sometimes to figure out how someone's going to interpret something. Our number is 800-933-5372. Let's go next to Steve in Dallas. Hello, Steve.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to call and say to Clive that I've been reading your books for years. I tend to find an author I like and keep reading the books by that author, and in your case, that has kept me extremely busy for a very long time.
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed them, yeah.
I certainly do. I feel like Dirk and Al and Rudy are family, and I'm delighted to see that the series has branched out and that it's being continued.
Oh, I'm so glad that you like that. It's I'm grateful. Thank you.
Now, are there more Dirk books on the horizon?
Oh yeah, there's going to be another one probably by November.
Mm-hmm. How do you decide that you're ready to try another character in another series? Is it just a matter of sort of ennui with what you've been working on and you want to come back to it later?
Well, like the Pneuma Files with Paul Compricos, it was the publisher that asked me, you know, if we could come up with another similar series. And then they asked me, too, because I had this ship, the Oregon, which is just looked like an old, beat-up, rusty tramp steamer. But underneath all this, it was just a cover-up. It was a modern ship with big engines and missiles and these mercenaries that had Van Goghs hanging on the bulkhead walls and a gourmet chef and all that. So everybody thought that would be great fun. And Jack DeBrell has worked on that one with me, and he's done a very nice job. And of course, they asked me about, you know, because the chase with Isaac Bell was so popular, if I could come up with, you know, another one on that. And then the couple, the Fargos, I thought it'd be fun to come up with a series with a couple, a husband and wife, because there isn't really a husband and wife. You know, there's all the female
Nick and Nora Charles.
Detectives, and that was it exactly, with the Thin Man. And I thought it'd be fun to have a couple that, you know, banters back and forth and, you know, drinks and, you know, and they look for treasure and they're wealthy, so when they find it, they give it to charities and things like that. And they have the dog. And so it just, Spartan Gold was the first one. Everybody liked it, so it's great fun.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Plano and speak with Susie. Hello, Susie.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you.
I just wanted to make a comment to Clive. First of all, I love your book.
Thank you.
I am a would-be author, and I'm curious. There's such a smile in your voice and an easiness in your spirit. And for a would-be author who's struggling, I don't know how you do that. Do you, besides the wine and the cigar?
Oh, no, I can, even if you like, I could sing, you know, If You Knew Susie Like I Know Susie.
Well, I know you know, it's a lot of work. It's hard work. Mm-hmm. And you use the word fun often. And I think you have to find fun in what you're doing. And I was just curious if there's anything that you could recommend for authors to do to make the process easier.
Okay. What you do, for example, Hemingway, when I say copied, he didn't copy, but he studied Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. The great story is Thomas Wolfe, when he was in the Merchant Marine, he was at shore one day and he bought this book, James Joyce's Ulysses, a used copy that was, you know, it's about the size of a phone book. And he copied that book for, you know, months while they were at sea. And when he finished, he took all this stack of paper and threw it off, you know, the stern into the sea. And his his shipmate said, "My God, after you copied all that for all these months, why did you throw it away?" And Thomas Wolfe said, "Because now I know how to write a book." And I used in the beginning you study the style, the structure. You don't plagiarize the story, of course. Style, structure, plotting, characterization, you know, and all this. And I think I used Alastair MacLean in the first two books I wrote. And then I drifted into my own style and copy and everything else. So study a successful author in the genre you're interested in writing in. And believe me, you don't have to go to school. It's all there. But you have to look beyond the story and study how they put it together, the first person, third person, prologue, epilogue, however they do it. And as I say, that it's all there. You just have to, you know, winnow it out.
Do you ever have a great scene that for whatever reason has to be excised from one novel, but you love it so much that you find a way to adapt it for another novel, another character?
No, I've always tried to be different in each book like that, so I haven't lifted one from the other. No, I've never done that.
And do you start ever with a series of scenes and think these eight things would work really well together, and then you have to sort of craft a plot that brings them all together?
Yes, I've done that quite frequently.
Mm-hmm. And you said that usually when you're ending one, you're sort of already thinking about the next one. Are the scenes the easy part? Is it the overwhelming story that's more challenging?
No, it's the scenes, really, because I float one scene into the other, and then I try to put myself in the reader's place. I'll think, what would the reader like to see? Well, obviously, I'm not psychic, but I can think it's slowing down now. You know, maybe I'll throw in like a hurricane, you know, mm-hmm. this kind of a thing. And so you have to stop and as I say, you're writing, you know, for somebody. It's like, let's face it, if you want to be hard-headed about it, you're developing a product.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and if the product is good, it'll sell. And it's the same thing. You have to think of who this product is going to, in this case, the reader. And, you know, how do I satisfy the reader? How does he enjoy this? What do I have to say or do to you know, encourage him to keep writing?
Spoken like the former ad man that you are.
I suppose. Yeah, that carried over.
Mm-hmm. Do you make an assumption about who's picking up the book? Do you have a maybe five people in mind that are sort of prototypes?
I try to make it as universal as I can mm-hmm. because I get letters from I think the youngest I've ever had on the Dirk Pitt book is 8 years old, and then it goes all the way up into the 90s. So I try to make it a universal type read, you know, and I get so many young people that read it, and the great part, just like speaking last night at the theater, that all the young people that came up to me and said that, you know, they were inspired by my book to take up diving, or they're going in the marine biology and the marine sciences and all this. So this has always been a great love that, you know, I was able to do this.
What do you do when somebody shakes your hand at a signing or puts up their hand at a speaking event and says, here's what you ought to do, and suggests an idea to you?
It's very frequent, but I can't take it. You know, yeah. I can't use it. I mean, there's a legal problem there. People write me, you know, fun plots, but I just can't use them.
Mm-hmm. Do you always have the life history of the character? Say you're going to do a series of 10 mm-hmm. novels. Do you, sort of in the back of your mind, know birth mm-hmm. to death of this character?
Pretty much, because in developing the characters, you know, the first thing, you can't have the same descriptions. So you have to just, you build this character, like, you know, with blocks, in a sense. You know, first of all, you have to get an appearance. What's he like as far as looks? Clothing, you know, what does he kind of generally wear? His manner, you know, personality, and this sort of thing. And you can really get into a character. The villains are the most fun.
Mm-hmm.
Even actors like to play villains.
I guess a lot of them have surprising villains. This one, I have to tell you, really, I did not see it coming.
Mm-hmm.
We won't give anything else away.
The butler did it.
I guess the last thing I want to ask you is what you imagine. Do you ever think of retiring?
No, I don't think I could. I have friends that, you know, they go out and play golf, and I think I couldn't do that. I used to like to play golf, but I always thought that, God, when I'm out there, I should be accomplishing something.
You know? Working on something.
Yeah, right. So, I don't think I'll retire. I'll probably, you'll find this old skeleton in cobwebs bent over a computer someday.
Lots of people are happy that you're still at the computer. The new book by Clive Cussler is the second in the Isaac Bell series. It is called The Wrecker. You can meet Clive tonight at 7 at a book signing event at the Barnes & Noble at Lincoln Park in Dallas. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.